The Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw is quoted as saying that politics is the last resort for the scoundrels. It's a funny line, quintessentially Shaw. But its attribution to Shaw, I'm sorry to say, is dubious. Shaw appears never to have said this. He did say, however, that everyone over 40 is a scoundrel. If that's true, then I should inform you, in the interest of transparency, that a scoundrel stands before you this evening. He's speaking to you now, so be forewarned. Certain is the attribution of the following line to Boys Penrose, a contemporary of Shaw and a U.S. senator. Public office, Penrose once said, is the last refuge of the incompetent. That's also a funny line, maybe more true. Also Shaw-esque in tone. We might wonder whether Penrose ever applied this line to himself, or did he apply it only to the other members of the Senate? Both phrases, the dubious one from Shaw and the certain one from Penrose, adapt an older adage coined by Samuel Johnson, the 18th century master of English letters. Johnson's biographer, James Boswell, reports that Dr. Johnson once called not politics, but patriotism, the last refuge of the scoundrel. At first, hearing Dr. Johnson's line isn't as funny as the other two. It doesn't cause one to laugh, but to think, and then fret, about how virtue, even a high virtue like patriotism, can sometimes cloak vice. The line warns that a politician draped in the flag might be a wolf in sheep's clothing. Even if they were delivered tongue-in-cheek, all three phrases express a certain unease with politics. And more than just unease, it would seem. Each expresses a certain cynicism regarding politics, both in terms of the work of politics and of the men and women who undertake political service. The work itself is seen as corrupting, or perhaps simply the refuge of the already corrupted. The implication is that noble souls, honest men and women, should avoid engaging in politics. Their virtue and honor will be stained if they do. People in every age, of course, have suffered unease with politics and political leaders. But this perennial unease seems only recently to have led to cynicism. One doesn't detect the same cynicism in medieval authors, for example. Take Dante, a kind of George Bernard Shaw of the 14th century. Dante suffered personally at the hands of political leaders. They forced him into exile, to live far away from his native Florence. In the Divine Comedy, Dante places several of these leaders, princes and popes alike, in hell. Yet for all his suffering, Dante did not sour to the political aspect of human life. He remained convinced of the nobility that politics and political leaders naturally possess. As evidence for this reverence, consider Dante's placement of just rulers in heaven. He places them in the sixth sphere of paradise, above the theologians and the philosophers. Thomas Aquinas, too, maintained a reverence for politics despite suffering at the hands of political leaders. Aquinas lost a brother in the mid-13th century squabbles between the Pope and the Holy Roman Emperor. Still, despite his family's suffering, Aquinas maintained his intellectual grasp on the political good. He wrote to the king of Cyprus that rulers, quote, bear a special likeness to God, since the ruler does in his kingdom what God does in the world, which is governed. Consequently, quote, good kings are most pleasing to God and are to be most highly rewarded by him. In the Divine Comedy, Dante adopted Aquinas' teaching on this point. The writings of authors like Dante and Aquinas prompt us to ask why medieval thinkers held politics and political leaders in high regard. It's not that medieval rulers were more virtuous than our own, or that medieval men and women were less aware than we of our leaders' weaknesses. For every Louis IX of France, there was a John of England. The French and the English were well aware of the virtues of the former and the vices of the latter. What maintained medieval reverence for politics, despite the inconstancy of medieval rulers, was, as Aquinas and Dante reveal, an unflagging recognition of the nobility of the political common good. Following the classical writers of ancient Greece and Rome, medieval thinkers maintained a high regard for the common good as a good of individuals better than their particular goods. Work for the common good, therefore, was considered better and more important than work for one's own particular good. Or better said, the pursuit of one's particular good was itself elevated when it was joined to the pursuit of the common good. This high regard for the common good was applied directly to the work aimed specifically at pursuing and supporting the common good, politics, as well as to those persons charged with governing the common good, political rulers. For the medievals, both the work and the worker, tied explicitly to the common good, acquired the high dignity and nobility of the common good itself. For the rest of this talk, I would like to examine, so as better to identify, the good that the medievals understood as dignifying politics and political leaders. We speak a lot today about the common good, but very few of us, including our leaders, have a clear sense of what the common good is and why it is to be sought, supported, and revered. As a guide for our examination, we will take the aforementioned St. Thomas Aquinas, a leading intellectual light in his own day, who is still esteemed by Catholics as the Church's common doctor. Aquinas never wrote a treatise on the common good, but he described the nobility of this good in several of his writings, including his masterwork, the Summa Theologiae. Like Aristotle, Aquinas deemed the common good as the most divine of earthly goods. Accordingly, he judged the human striving for the common good the most divine of human strivings. Quote, "It certainly belongs to the love that obtains among men that a man should strive for and preserve the good of even a single individual. But it remains better and more divine," Aquinas writes, "that this love should be shown to the whole nation and to cities." What did Aquinas see in the common good that led him to revere it as the highest of the human person's earthly goods? And what follows, I will try to answer this question. Before we begin to examine Aquinas' teaching on the common good, however, let us take a moment to appreciate just how slippery a concept the common good is. Not only politicians today, but also philosophers give divergent descriptions of the common good. Even the Catholic Church, which lists the common good as one of the four pillars of her social teaching, struggles to articulate one consistent description of the common good. For example, in her official documents, the Church offers not one but two descriptions of the common good. Though in these documents, the Church portrays the two descriptions as distinct expressions of a single description, they are in fact different portrayals of the common good drawn from contrasting philosophical traditions. One description is historically modern and highlights the common good's usefulness to individuals. The other description is classical and features the common good's transcendence over other goods. as ambiguously described, the common good is less clarifying of the Catholic social teaching than the Church's documents present it as being. The concept's two descriptions introduce not lucidity but tension into the Church's doctrine. Let's take a closer look at this tension. The modern description of the common good finds expression in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, which describes the common good as, quote, the sum total of social conditions which allow people either as groups or individuals to reach their fulfillment more fully and more easily. It's the first text there on your sheet. Word for word, the Catechism reproduces this definition from Vatican II's Gaudium et Spes. For their part, the authors of Gaudium et Spes adapted the definition that Pope John XXIII had recently introduced into the Church's social lexicon. In his 1961 encyclical, Mater Magistra, written to affirm the mid-20th century culture of progress, the good Pope identified the common good for the first time in a magisterial text as, quote, all those social conditions which favor the full development of human personality. The Catechism's definition, therefore, recapitulates a 50-year tradition within magisterial teaching of describing the common good as a utilitarian good. It is a quantitative sum of conditions instrumental to a person's individual and social thriving. Published a decade after the Catechism, the compendium of the social doctrine of the Church amends the Catechism's quantitative and instrumental view of the common good. Though it repeats the Catechism's definition, calling it, quote, primary and broadly accepted, the compendium adds a classical description of the common good, which sees the good's commonness to derive from the good's unity and transcendence rather than from its division in utility. Second quote there on your sheet. The common good does not consist in the simple sum of the particular goods of each subject of a social entity. Belonging to everyone and to each person, the common good is and remains common because it is indivisible and because only together is it possible to attain. Thus does the compendium add a second, contrasting description of the common good to the Catechism's. Against the Catechism's description of the common good as a divisible sum, the compendium describes the common good as a whole, whose indivisible goodness, as transcending the sum of its parts, diffuses itself to the parts as their shared final cause. It is thus that, according to the compendium, the common good belongs at once to, quote, everyone, the whole, and to each person as a part of the whole. We might sum up the distinction between the Catechism's and the compendium's descriptions of the common good in this way. The Catechism describes the common good as dividing in distributing its constitutive parts as the particular goods of individual persons, while the compendium describes persons as constituting the parts of the common good, to whom the transcendent goodness of the ordering of the persons themselves diffuses undividedly and commonly. There's a big difference between these two descriptions. It's not our purpose this evening to settle the problem raised by the dual descriptions of the common good in the Church's official teaching. It's certainly possible to read the two descriptions as more harmonious than I've read them here. My only reason for mentioning the problem is to illustrate how difficult it is to describe the common good. It's important to mention, however, that Aquinas' description of the common good, to which we now turn, aligns more with the classical description of the compendium than with the modern description of the Catechism. in order to describe adequately what a common good is, so that we can describe adequately what the political common good is, one has to explain first how it is that a common good is a good, and then how it is that a common good is common. Aquinas provides both of these explanations. When Aquinas says that a common good is a good, he means that as a good, a common good is something that human beings desire insofar as they desire their perfection. In other words, a common good, like all goods proper to human beings, provides some perfection to the human creature, some augmentation of his or her being, such that the creature becomes more human. More of one's human nature is actualized for possessing it. Human goods include food, shelter, clothing, friendship, family, and city, truth, virtue, and health, grace, the church, the sacraments, and finally, God. Some of these human goods are common goods. So much for Aquinas' explanation of how a common good is a good. That's the easy part. Now we examine Aquinas' explanation of how a common good is common. This explanation is more involved, for we have to make several distinctions to arrive finally at the specific type of commonness that renders a common good common. First, Aquinas divides all of the goods that are proper to human beings into two broad categories, particular goods and common goods. Particular goods are goods that diffuse their goodness simply to one person. Thus, a particular good is the good of one person alone. My shirt, my shoes, my idea, my milkshake, my paycheck, my grades, etc., are all examples of particular goods. By being the proper good of one person, particular goods are necessarily alien to all other persons. My shirt is not your shirt. My paycheck is not your paycheck. My grades are not your grades. And vice versa, your shirt is not my shirt. Your paycheck is not my paycheck. Your grades are not my grades. By contrast, common goods are goods that can diffuse their goodness to many persons. In other words, a common good is the good of many persons at once. Accordingly, by being the proper good of one person, a common good is not prohibited from being the proper good of another person. A common good is the good of both. In fact, a common good is the good of all to whom the common good is a proper good. The good of the family is the proper good of every member of the family. The good of the university is the proper good of every member of the university. The good of the city is the proper good of every member of the city. That's the first distinction that we have to make in order to grasp how it is that a common good is common. A common good is simply not a particular good. Though just one in number, a common good is a good shareable by many. But there's more to say. For although we often use the term common good to speak about shareable goods, not every shareable good is a common good properly speaking. What do we mean by this? How do we tell the difference between a shareable good that only appears common and a shareable good that is in fact common? The compendium reminds us how. A common good, the compendium says, is an indivisible whole, not a divisible sum. This is the second distinction that we have to make. Many of the shareable goods that we call common goods are not indivisible wholes, but are instead divisible sums. We have to learn how to distinguish the two. An example of a divisible sum that we often call a common good is a collection of particular goods. A candy jar in a doctor's office, a company's pension fund, and a city's water reservoir are examples of a collection of particular goods. Pizza is also a good example. We routinely call these collections common goods because, as the source of some pleasure enjoyed by many persons, the collection appears as a common good to its beneficiaries. But we have to be careful. These collections are not common, properly speaking, for they lack the principle distinctive of common goods, a unity, a oneness, a wholeness that diffuses its goodness widely. Unlike a true common good, a collection of particular goods does not constitute a unity, a oneness, a wholeness capable of diffusing its goodness wholly and universally to its participants. Instead, as an aggregate of goods, a collection diffuses its goodness by dividing itself and dispersing to individuals the particular goods that it collects. A candy jar dispenses individual candies. A pension fund dispenses individual checks. A water reservoir dispenses individual quantities of water. A pizza is split up into 8 or 10 slices. Thus, what attracts individuals to the candy jar, the pension fund, and the water reservoir, the pizza, is not the jar itself or the fund itself, the reservoir itself, or even the pizza itself, as if each of these were a single common good. Rather, what attracts individuals to the jar, the fund, the reservoir, the pizza, is the piece of candy they receive from the jar, the monthly check they receive from the fund, and the gallon of water they receive from the reservoir, the 4 pieces they receive from the box of pizza. The jar, the fund, the reservoir, the pizza have to be divided in order for their goodness to be enjoyed. Hence, despite our use of the term common good for a collection of particular goods, we should not confuse a divisible sum for an indivisible whole. We should not confuse a collection of particular goods for a common good, properly so called. A common good, properly speaking, therefore, is an indivisible whole and not a divisible sum. Another distinction is in order here, however. This is the third distinction toward describing the political common good adequately. In order to understand just what kind of common good the political common good is, we must identify what kind of indivisible whole the political common good is. First, Aquinas helps us to see there are 3 types of wholes that exist. Quantitative wholes, substantial wholes, and wholes of order. As a common good, the political common good is a whole of the last kind, a whole of order. Let us examine briefly each of these 3 kinds of wholes in order to grasp why the political common good, insofar as it is a whole, can only be a whole of order. The first type of whole is a quantitative whole, or whole of a simple quantity of something. It is a whole that has no parts. Therefore, the division of the whole leads not to a breakdown of the whole into its parts, it has none, but rather to an increase of individual instances of the original whole, just in smaller sizes. For example, dividing a line results in having more but smaller lines. Similarly, dividing a brick of chocolate results in having more but smaller pieces of chocolate. The metaphysics of quantitative wholes is pretty simple. In a quantitative whole, a substantial form does not function to unite parts into a greater whole. It functions simply to determine what kind of thing a given quantity is. Consequently, when a quantitative whole is divided, its substantial form is itself divided and remains complete in each of the resulting pieces of the original whole. The smaller line remains fully a line, and the smaller piece of chocolate remains fully chocolate. The second type of whole for Aquinas is a substantial whole. Here, substantial form does function as an inner principle, binding parts together into a whole. The division of the whole thus leads to the reduction of the whole into its essential parts. Under this category of wholes are located natural or organic wholes, namely living beings, whose substantial form, the soul, functions to confer identity and activity both to the whole, the living body, and to each of its parts, the head, the hands, the eyes, the heart. In substantial wholes, no part retains either its identity or activity apart from the whole. Aquinas' famous example of the cadaver illustrates this principle. When it loses its soul, a living body is not only no longer a living body, it is no longer a body. What is left is a cadaver. A cadaver was a body, of course, but now without the soul, without its substantial form, the cadaver lacks all of its former identity, unity, and activity. Formerly quickened by a soul, the cadaver assumes a new substantial form that confers on it and all of its parts a different and lifeless activity, identity, and unity. The third type of whole is a virtual whole, or a whole of order. What makes a whole of order a virtual whole as opposed to a substantial whole is that within a whole of order, the whole substantial form relates not substantially but only accidentally to the parts. This means something very important for the parts of a whole of order. In a whole of order, each part retains its own identity and activity apart from the identity and activity bestowed on it by the whole. Thus, a whole of order is not a substantial whole, like a human being, or a dog, or a plant, but rather a virtual whole, like a house, or a society of persons. A virtual whole, while it is not a substantial whole, is still a real whole. It's just that its parts do not exist solely to constitute the whole. A doorknob remains a doorknob whether or not it forms part of a house. So too, a man remains a man whether or not he becomes a father of a family or a citizen of the city. When Aquinas speaks of the political common good, therefore, he is speaking of the good of a whole of the third type, a whole of order. The political common good is a whole of order that has persons as its parts. Now, when some people hear that persons are parts of a greater whole, they get nervous. Isn't this the philosophical recipe for the totalitarian oppression of individuals? For some Catholic thinkers, the answer is yes. For example, Jacques Maritain thought that persons shouldn't be considered as parts of greater wholes because, he argued, the notion of part is opposed to the notion of person. The person is himself a whole, free from other wholes. Maritain worried that if the person were a part of a whole, he would lose his freedom and identity. He would become like a heart in a ribcage or a piston in an engine, a natural prisoner to the political community to which he belongs. The totalitarians of the 20th century certainly saw the individual in this way. After all, it was Mussolini who chanted, "All within the state, nothing outside of the state, nothing against the state." Aquinas held a different view. He understood the person's relation to the political community in exactly the opposite terms. When Aquinas says that, as, quote, "every part is ordained to the whole, as imperfect to perfect," so man is part of the perfect community, the political community. He does not mean in saying this that man constitutes a part of some substantial organic whole. For Aquinas, a citizen is not like a heart enclosed in the ribcage of a living being. Still less is the citizen a part of a quantitative whole. As a part of a whole of order, the human being maintains his identity as rational, and his activity as free. He maintains his ties to his family, which the city can never sever. And he retains his vocation to supernatural happiness, which the city cannot replace. Oriented naturally to communities both lower and higher than the city, the human being finds in the common good of the city not his final, but nonetheless his highest earthly good. A good that, by providential design, contributes to his perfection. So for Aquinas, this good is what politics is all about. The common good of the political community. The good of a special whole of order that has persons for its parts. Persons as citizens, to each of whom, as parts of the political community, the good of the political community belongs as their proper good. This view of the common good has many implications for how we might understand politics and our political life together. It can shape how we understand government, which is not itself the common good, but is rather the necessary instrument of a political community to organize and maintain its political ordering. This view of the common good can shape as well our understanding of voting. For example, what are we voting for when we enter the booth? Our particular good as individuals, or our common good as citizens? We'll have to save that question for another discussion. I'd like to end this evening's talk by examining the reason why Aquinas holds the political common good in great esteem. Remember that he calls the common good divine, as well as one's work for the common good, divine. Not literally divine, of course. The city is not God. Thanks be to God. But Aquinas recognizes that the common good has a divine-like quality, which is to say that it imitates God's divine goodness in a particular way. I close my remarks by examining how, according to Aquinas, the common good imitates the divine goodness. The key to appreciating Aquinas' elevated view of the common good is to understand why, for Aquinas, one's common good is better than one's particular good. One's common good is not better than one's particular good because the common good is bigger, as Aquinas explains. The common good is better than the particular good because it is greater, ontologically speaking. The first step that Aquinas takes towards describing the excellence of the common good is to note that not all goods, as final causes, diffuse their goodness to the same extent. Some goods communicate their goodness widely to a number of effects, while others diffuse their goodness narrowly to only a few effects, or even to just one effect. Goods, therefore, rank themselves naturally in a hierarchy based on the extent or reach of their self-diffusion. Widely diffusing goods sit above narrowly diffusing goods in this hierarchy. To establish this point, Aquinas comments on a text from Aristotle's Metaphysics. This is text 3 on your sheet. It must be acknowledged, Aquinas writes, that the higher a cause is, the more it extends its causality to many. A higher cause thus has its own proper higher effect, which is more common and is found in many things. Aquinas' observation here is a simple syllogism demonstrating the commonness of higher causes. The higher a final cause is, the greater its diffusion. The greater a final cause's diffusion, the more varied are its effects. Consequently, the higher a cause is, the more varied are its effects. Thus, the higher a cause is, the more common it is to varied effects. In other words, to climb the scale toward higher causes is to climb the scale toward increasingly common causes. We have to note right away that for Aquinas, the self-diffusion of higher goods to more effects is not a matter of strict quantity. That is to say, higher goods are not for that reason bigger goods. And bigger goods are not for that reason higher or more common goods. For example, according to recent records, the number of enlisted members of the U.S. Armed Forces is double that of the entire population of the Solomon Islands. As a result, does the common good of the U.S. Armed Forces rank higher than the common good of the Solomon Islands? Simply because the former affects more people than the latter? The answer is no. Higher goods are not higher because they extend themselves to a quantifiably larger number of participants. Properly speaking, they are higher because their proper effect extends to more types of lower goods, whose quantifiable size remains beside the point. Here we look at quotation 4 on your sheet. Aquinas explains, in the realm of human arts, the political arts, which sit above the military arts, extend themselves to the entire realm of the community. The military arts, however, extend themselves only to those things contained within the realm of the military. For Aquinas, the political community stands above the military community because the political community extends itself more widely. It covers a broader range of lower goods, including domestic, economic, and cultural goods, than does the military community. In point of fact, the military common good is one of the goods to which the political common good extends. The military good is thus enfolded within the political good. For this reason, the common good of any political community, regardless of its size, is always greater than the common good of any military force. Accordingly, it would be proper for the U.S. Armed Forces to act generously and jeopardize its good for the good of the Solomon Islands. By the same token, it would be improper for the Solomon Islands to jeopardize its good for the good of the U.S. Armed Forces. Once Aquinas establishes the proper ordering of higher and lower goods, he makes a practical observation. Because higher goods extend themselves more widely than lower ones, they demand a higher and nobler love from their participants. Aquinas makes this claim when commenting on Aristotle's assertion in the Ethics that statesmanship ranks highest among the practical sciences. This is text 5 on your sheet. It is clear that every cause, inasmuch as it is stronger and more important, extends itself to many proper effects. Therefore, the good which carries the note of final cause, inasmuch as it is stronger and more important, extends itself to many effects. Thus, if the same end were the good of one man and of the whole city, it seems better by far and more perfect to undertake, that is, either to procure or to save and preserve that which is the good of the whole city than that which is the good of one man. Now, certainly belongs to the love that obtains among men that a man should strive for and preserve the good even of a single individual. But it remains better and more divine that this love should be shown to the whole nation and to cities. That is to say, while indeed love should be shown to only one city, By far, it remains more divine to show this love to the whole nation, in which many cities are contained. Aristotle calls more divine that which relates more to the likeness of God, who is the universal cause of all good. In this passage from his commentary on Aristotle's Ethics, Aquinas distinguishes common goods from particular goods as one should distinguish higher goods from lower ones. There are many interesting things that we could point out in Aquinas' reasoning here, but let us focus on just one thing, which centers on the relation of one's particular good to his common good. Notice what Aquinas describes here regarding the love of friends in relation to the love of the common good. Aquinas assuages the fear that some might have of one's pursuit of the common good suppressing one's pursuit of his particular good. Specifically, he defends the integrity of particular goods from the supposed menace of common goods by recalling the essential role that particular goods play in friendship. Certainly, Aquinas writes in the quotation above, it belongs to the love that obtains among men that a man should strive for and preserve the good even of a single individual. To refute the suspicion that higher goods somehow eclipse lower ones, Aquinas points to how friends naturally pursue each other's particular good, the good even of a single individual, as a requirement of their mutual love. A friend would fail in friendship if he did not desire and pursue the other's good, including the other's particular good, as his very own. Thus, as evidence contrary to any supposed antagonism between higher and lower goods, Aquinas recalls how friendship of its essence trades in particular goods, the higher call of higher goods notwithstanding. Friends do no violence to the common good when they lovingly supply the particular goods that each wants or needs. Aquinas is quick to note, however, that the mutual pursuit of particular goods does not exhaust the love of friendship. A friend seeks the whole good of his friend, which includes the friend's particular goods as well as his common goods. And it is here that the primacy of the common good reveals itself to Aquinas. While Aquinas says that it belongs to the love that obtains among men that a man should strive for and preserve the good even of a single individual, he completes the thought by adding that, quote, it remains better and more divine that this love should be shown to the whole nation and to cities. In other words, it remains better and more divine when the love aimed at preserving and sustaining a friend's particular good is aimed at preserving and sustaining his common good first and foremost. Contrary to the modern reader's worry, therefore, Aquinas' doctrine of the common good does not preclude the pursuit of either one's own or one's friend's particular good. He merely notes in both respects the greater worth of pursuing the higher good. Aquinas' argument here in the Ethics commentary rests on what he sees as determining the greater worth of higher goods. This worth results not from the subjective will of the good's participants, whose evaluations of goodness can vary according to need. Rather, the greater worth of higher goods results from the objective makeup of the good. For Aquinas, higher goods are of their very nature more attractive. They exercise a stronger pull to themselves due to the greater density, so to speak, of their goodness. The thicker a good is ontologically, the farther its finality extends in diffusion of its abundant goodness. Goods are thus better, more attractive, and more expansive the more flush they are with objective goodness. Accordingly, participants owe higher goods a care and an attention commensurate with their exceptional quality. All things being equal, therefore, higher goods deserve more love and attention than lower goods. It is with regard to the ontological worth of higher goods and the commensurate love that they demand that Aquinas adopts the language of Aristotle and calls the love of higher goods more divine. He concludes the passage we have been examining. Aristotle, quote, calls more divine that which relates more to the likeness of God, who is the universal cause of all good. Because God is the highest of all common goods, extending his goodness to all things universally as their perfection and end. Aquinas observes something godlike in created goods that, in a way similar to the divine good, transcend their singularity and extend their goodness to many effects. Likewise, Aquinas sees something godlike in the rational creature who transcends his singularity and loves a common good commonly. By loving the common good as shareable, the individual is taken up into the community created by the common good. He becomes a participant in its greater goodness, and thus he bears in himself something of the dignity of its greater good. Though the individual bears a certain dignity as an individual made in the image and likeness of God, his dignity is augmented by the good of his family, and it is augmented further by the greater good of his political community. This evening, we've asked the question, what is politics about anyway? I've answered that question by describing the good that is the principle and end of our political life together, the common good of the political community. I've recounted what Aquinas understands the political common good to be, the good of a whole of order, the good of the ordering of persons as a political community, whose goodness is the proper and higher good of each of the persons constituting the community. While I've not had time this evening to highlight the many implications that this view of the common good holds for our political life together, implications that challenge today's political status quo, just describing adequately what the common good is provides an important service. This accurate description reveals the political common good's importance to human life, as well as the providential role that it plays in human happiness. As the good that is more divine than our particular good, the political common good raises our eyes above the particular good. It points us beyond the self, and thus it prepares us to love even higher goods, toward which the political common good serves as something of a stepping stone. By God's design, the earthly city points ahead to the heavenly city. And our political life here, believe it or not, is meant to prepare us for an everlasting social and political life there. Ultimately, that is what politics is all about. Politics is not the last resort for the scoundrels. Properly understood, politics is the first school of the saints. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Yeah.
What would Aquinas say about how the individual could best enter into the common good?
Yeah. See, that's interesting, the way you even put the question, because it betrays a modern sense of the question that wouldn't occur to Aquinas. Because you, the way you articulate, maybe this is not what you meant, but this is kind of what our words point to. How does the individual kind of enter into the political common good? For Aquinas, there's no choice in the matter. Every individual is a part of some political common good, you know. For Aquinas, there's no mere individual, which is to say, in history, in real existence, there's no human being who is not at any point a part of his family. There's not a point in his life when he's not a part of his political community. That nature provides these two communities. Nature provides these two goods that always and everywhere are perfective of every individual. So as working, we can kind of, in our own abstract thinking, kind of separate the individual out from his family and from his city. But in terms of his identity and of the actual concrete goods that are his properly as an individual, qua member of his family, qua member of his political community, his city, he's always in. The question then becomes, how is it in his everyday life that he pursues then the good that's his? In fact, that's already his. That's his by nature. Now, we probably know all kind of asocial, apolitical people who don't, you know, engage. But it doesn't mean that the good of their political community isn't their proper good. You know, that it doesn't belong to them as something that's something that they don't already have a just claim to. Which, in justice, the family owes them some share in that good. In justice, the city owes them some share, you know, in its good. I think the more properly speaking, from Aquinas' point of view, he would, if he's looking around today, he's like asking, well, not is it how individuals enter into the political common good? It's why aren't individuals pursuing that good? I mean, he would recognize a kind of individualism that's taken hold, you know, in modernity that wasn't quite present there in the medieval world. Certainly, speculatively and just kind of developing kind of the philosophical anthropology. I think for us, modernity developed kind of more individualistic anthropology, out of which I think we've kind of followed. You know, it's now we feel its effects, I think, in the family, in the city now, in ways that Aquinas himself wouldn't have encountered, I don't think. I mean, there's a whole lot more that can be said about that, but
So we talked about at the beginning about how like a lot of people view a lot of like scoundrels in politics.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if Aquinas or you have any light into like why is it so easy for people who are probably starting out with the idea of seeing the good to fall into this.
Right. Yeah, it's Mr. Smith goes to Washington, right? And then, you know, falls into the swamp, you know. I have the privilege of once a month leading a Bible study, kind of a little scripture study for Catholics who work on Capitol Hill. And there are some congressmen who come. And I've been edified by being with them because when you hear them speak, I mean, you get a real sense of who they are as human beings and as disciples. They're really serious about that, you know. They take their job seriously. They take their family seriously. They take their district seriously. I mean, they know what they're there to do, and they know what they want to do, and that's why they're congressmen. But to also hear the utter frustration, you know, that they have, that what they came, in a sense, to Washington to do, they find absolutely impossible to do, you know. They tick off, you know, several factors there. A lot of it has to do just with the machinery, kind of just the physical machinery of government, the way our federal government has come to work. I think for many of them, it's just not working. That Congress can't deliberate and make law, which in the way that the founders imagined it to, and even maybe two generations it was still able to do, but doesn't anymore. So that gets into a lot of particular questions just about Washington itself. But what they see, and I think this is what shocks them the most, or really maybe hurts them the most, is to see how kind of throwing yourself into the current machinery of government really just chews people up and spits them out. That it's a vicious, vicious world. It's that for a lot of, it's hard. I don't want to say, you don't want to start kind of saying like the majority of people who work in the federal government, you know, or this or that. It's not that. I think it's that at their level, in the positions where they kind of operate, the kind of pride and lust for power, you know, that controls people's everyday life, consumes a good number of people, and I also know other people who have left their jobs to wherever they are. They moved to Washington to work for the administration, not just this one, but previous ones too, and they only last about 18 months, 2 years, because at that point either they become what it is that they've come to hate, or they just have to get out because there's nothing left for them to do, and it's really kind of, that's eye-opening, so there is, if you wanted to reflect on this from Aquinas' point of view, he would just say that the higher a good is, the more common it is, which means the more direction it needs, the more you need authority to kind of coordinate everyone's activity towards the enjoyment of that good. So that's, why something like government exists, in the first place. But because it requires a certain complexity of coordination to enjoy that good at each moment where decisions have to be made, it's just the opportunity for things to go bad, for people to pursue the right thing for the wrong reason, or to love the good that's common to all simply for themselves. And as Aquinas says, that's not to love the city properly as a citizen. That's to love the city as a tyrant loves the city. The tyrant, what does the tyrant do? The tyrant loves the city not for itself, but for himself. And once citizens start loving the city with that same love, then you're in trouble, and that's... I think that could be, a lens through which to understand our own current political moment. Just that the individualism that one can bring to his or her love of the common good doesn't exist just in those kind of pulling the levers of power. But, if that's the way citizens love the common good too, well, then you really don't have a community. The city becomes like the candy jar. Everybody's just going to it to grab what it is that they can claim, and there's nothing, there's no love, there's no friendship, there's nothing common that's shared, as should be in something like the city.
Mm-hmm. Apart from the function and dysfunction of city and nation, presumably, for the most part, in most cases, some remnant, let's call it, of common good subsists.
Right.
And so each of the citizens or residents or whatever they consider themselves is a beneficiary to some extent of this. But that implies, it seemed to me, reciprocity.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, you are not required, your career going forward, to aspire to be a legislator or an executive functionary or a president or a king.
Mm-hmm.
But you probably are required to have some kind of reciprocal, I'll call it friendship, that might not be the right word, friendship with the functioning, dysfunctioning unit which brings about this common good.
Mm-hmm.
And that gets very tricky very quickly.
Right. Yeah. So, one way in which Aquinas accounts for that is just the way he sees justice to unfold, in a political community. He sees that there, when you look at justice, you can talk about justice, justice is the rendering of the other his due. But there are actually three ways in which that takes place within a community. There's what he calls general illegal justice. That's what the individual owes injustice to the political community. There's distributive justice, that's what the political community owes to the individual citizen. And there's commutative justice, it's what individual citizens owe to each other in terms of parts of the greater whole. So you have these three kind of forms of justice all unfolding in anyone's individual life at all times. And so it's particularly through general justice and through distributive justice that you would have this reciprocity, this relation between citizen and political, the political whole, and the political whole to the part. Aquinas even says you have different kinds of prudence, you know, that perfect those two movements of justice. So that in general justice, you know, in the citizens rendering what's due to the political whole, you have political prudence, you know, which is basically kind of the citizens' perfect following of the law, you know.
Hence your upcoming lecture on voting.
That's right, exactly. Which is interesting because I think that is not just a question then of political prudence.
Right.
It's the citizens' participation in the other kind of prudence, regnative prudence, which is the prudence that's required of the political authority in rendering what's due to the individual citizen. That's regnative prudence. Aquinas sees that that's a higher one because of the good that's involved. So there, I mean, you see, I mean, from at least Aquinas' point of view, I mean, trying to account for the relation, the natural relation, and the virtuous relation that should, you know, exist between individual citizens and how it is that together they enjoy their common good together, and the role that the political authority has in that. He also says that, you know, justice is an interesting thing because to do the just thing doesn't mean that you have to agree that the just thing demanded is actually just. Aquinas doesn't think that when you, especially in terms of general justice or legal justice, that to render the other his due doesn't mean you have to agree that what is due to the other is in fact due to them. For example, you know, in terms of my what I owe to the political community is to, you know, obey the laws that are at least not unjust, you know. It was popular in the 70s, right? The federal speed limit was 55 miles an hour. I'm sure you had about 200 million Americans who thought that was absolutely ridiculous, you know. And no one followed it. Yeah. But the thing is, I mean, there's from Aquinas' point of view, the thing is that to render what is due, to render what's just, is to follow the speed limit. And that would be an act of justice, even though interiorly you think this is not, you know, in fact, you know, you disagree with the law. And the thing is, then you're free to work to get the law changed. So, so it's just, that's just another way of indicating that that because there can be disagreements among citizens about, let's say, the prudence of their authorities, there's still some friendship that should be seen there as an ideal. And Aquinas says that even in those areas where good people can disagree over issues of prudence, there shouldn't be this constant backbiting, citizens to their rulers and vice versa. That there should be a kind of ease and friendliness that shapes their relations. It's not always going to be the case, but I mean, you know, certainly something to strive for. I mean, what he's really kind of getting at there, if we wanted to put in our own day, is it's a warning against partisanship. You know, merely for pure political gain, we set up kind of lines of animosity. Which distracts us and hinders people from really enjoying entering fully into the enjoyment of the political conflict.
I think that partisanship is the right word, not political. When you're entering into partisanship,
right.
It's anti-political.
Right. Yep.
I want to just follow up on that because I have friends on both sides of the aisle, and even with friends that are at work, that I've had at work, you can't even talk about politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is so...
Right. It's toxic.
And it's not so much you talk about like hot button issues like abortion or other things, or war. And I always wondered about how Thomas Aquinas felt on, not about politics in general, but just like we come to a point where you can't even stand somebody who has just a different view. Like
right.
I always said, I don't agree with you, I respectfully disagree with
right.
you. Now, that was the way I was raised.
Right.
People are not like that.
Right.
And I think now we're going to have an election next year, and you're now seeing it, whether it's in social media, whether it's, you know, different groups, you know, violently protesting, or even people going on social media and trashing people.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Aquinas in this during social media. But what do you say, like, how can we as Catholics try to help build up the discourse. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of it, what you said, was spot on, especially the prudence, not everyone has prudence.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think, in my opinion, I think it's going to get worse
mm-hmm.
in some ways.
Right.
So how would you like answer?
Yeah. I mean, the part of it is that, it's exactly what, part of the remedy here is, I think, is exactly what Aquinas points out in terms of the hierarchy of goods. That on the one hand, yes, we do recognize that the political common good is the highest of our earthly goods, but it's not our absolute highest good. You know, that the political common good itself takes shape and models, you know, higher goods. For Aquinas, that would be first the kind of the order of the universe. And we don't tend to think in those terms anymore. But that to see ourselves as parts of a cosmos, you know. The ancients, the medievals, that was a reality for them. So to look up at the stars and to see the kind of ordered movement of the heavens taught a kind of lesson about how, you know, we order our own lives, you know, especially within the city, you know, so that the wise ruler was someone who knew something, you know, about his place, not just in the city, but in the cosmos, you know. We don't think about that anymore, which is to say, for a lot of people, maybe for a lot of us, there's no higher good than politics. Politics is the whole show, you know, and therefore to lose at politics is in a sense, it can be taken as like a religious offense. I mean, it's like the highest good is being offended, and therefore I've got to defend it, you know. And that can add a kind of unnecessary tension, you know, to our politics. I think if the citizenry realizes that, recognizes the political good for what it is in the context of higher goods and even God himself as the highest good, then we realize that, you know, good people can disagree about certain things. But it also requires that we have to have discussions not just about means to ends, and that's where good people can disagree, but about the ends themselves, and that's what's harder. You know, we're not good at that anymore, which is to say we don't have public discussions about the good. You know, what is it good to do? Not just in terms of fulfilling government functions, but, I mean, what are the goods that a political community should kind of focus on, you know? And that leads to the question, I mean, what is good for the human person, you know, first and foremost? And there we've got very little agreement on this question. That's a part of the reason for a lot of the rancor of our politics. If you don't have a common vision of the good and the hierarchy of goods, and because of that, you know, for a significant portion of the population, that the political good is simply the highest good. That's all there is. It's going to be tough to kind of achieve common ground. So I think in engaging, I mean, I think what the faith, the person of faith does is try to witness, I mean, in charity, in prudence, that the way you live your life, you demonstrate that you live for goods higher than just the political good. And as Aquinas says that, it's incumbent upon every person, every believer, to preach the gospel, but not always and everywhere. You know, there are some situations and some ways of preaching the gospel will actually do damage, you know, to the gospel. And he says, yeah, you have to be kind of savvy about that, circumspect and prudent in how and when and where, you know, you offer a word of witness or offer a word of correction. It has to be done, but not every time you get on Twitter or Facebook or, stand up in the public square. Yeah.
I don't mean to be pedantic about the word usage.
Yeah.
It strikes me that the distinction here is not that it's political victories.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that politics turns out to be some of these people's highest goods. It's mm-hmm. their partisan view.
Well, that's an important distinction.
It has always struck me, I have friends who are anarchists and communists, conservatives and
right.
Trumpists and common goodists.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I always hold the discussion to when it's politics, that it's actually politics, and we're sort of entering into the realm of Aquinas and Aristotle here.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about these other things as partisanship.
Right.
Now let's see how it relates.
Right.
I'd like to say it works better than it does. It works once in a while.
Yeah, no. And I think that's a good distinction, because I think we need more of the former kinds of discussion, you know, whereas we do get wrapped up mostly in the latter kind.
Yeah.
You know.
So the topic for this talk itself was what is politics about itself, but maybe I've missed the definition in the talk of what it's about, but what does Aquinas say politics is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if it may not be a particular question for him, but I guess from my point of view, working with Aquinas here is, I guess what I understood politics to be is, the common work of a citizenry towards the achievement of its political common good, yeah. Which is to say, it's not just the work of government, you know. It's necessarily that, but it's more than that. That it's the work of all the parts, you know, in coordination with each other, guided by the political authority, towards not only the common achievement but also the common enjoyment of the political order, of the political common good. So that's, I guess, what I would see, you know, politics as. Which I think is what kind of Aristotle, you know, kind of sees it as, that. It's the pursuit of that good that's not just my individual good, it's not just my domestic good, but it's the good of the polis, you know, which is whatever is involved in that, you know, is politics.
And it can be instantiated in many different kinds of machinery.
Exactly. Different kinds of machinery, and requires all kinds of different virtues depending on where you, what kind of part you are, you know, in the whole. All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.